Captain Nicola Goddard was killed in a firefight in Afghanistan on May 17, 2006. She was Canada's first female service member to die in combat. A trailblazer, Nicola was the captain of a gun troop at a time when the role of women in combat was still being debated. For Her Country is a podcast dedicated to honoring her legacy by spotlighting powerful female leaders in the Canadian Armed Forces.
Nicola was born and spent her early years in Papua New Guinea, a country north of Australia known as being one of the most culturally diverse in the world. My parents, originally from England and Canada, met as teachers and later married there. When Nicola was three, my parents moved home to Canada with her and my other sister, Victoria. Everyone lived with my grandparents in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, before moving to Black Lake, a Dene community in Saskatchewan, about 60 kilometers south of the Northwest Territories. We spent the next two decades moving around Canada for my parents' assignments and education, from Dundurn and LaRonge, Saskatchewan, Pangrandung, Baffin Island, Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and Antigonish, Nova Scotia. When Nicola was in grade 12, we were living in Antigonish. A military recruiter presented at Nick's school, and she became excited about the possibilities a career with the military could create, free education, and a job after graduation, focused on making the world a better place. Both sides of my family have a history of public service through education, medicine, and law enforcement, and I think Nicola saw the military as an opportunity to continue this legacy. And so Nick went to the Royal Military College in Kingston and joined the artillery. After graduation, she was posted to the 1st Regiment Royal Canadian Horse Artillery in Shiloh, Manitoba. In time, her work took her across Canada. She spent time in Gagetown, New Brunswick for training. She spent a summer in British Columbia fighting forest fires, a winter at Rogers Pass shooting down avalanches, proactively clearing snowpacks so that they don't impact homes, businesses, and other infrastructure. In early 2006, Nicola was deployed to Afghanistan. While my family has a deep history of service, the military was new to us, and that created some natural uncertainty and concern. Nick's role was as a forward observation officer, responsible for directing artillery and airborne fire. The Christmas before Nick was deployed, she told my parents that she was doing her job so that as educators and humanitarians, they could later do theirs. When Nick was in Afghanistan, she sent emails home to our family with updates from her deployment. In her fourth letter home, she reflected on the experience of serving alongside citizens of Afghanistan who were desperately fighting to create a better home for themselves and their families. She wrote, "I think that these people are trying to achieve something that we in Canada have long since taken for granted. They lay down their lives daily to seize something that is so idealistic it is almost impossible to define." I love that last line, to seize something that is so idealistic, it is almost impossible to define. It so beautifully captures why Canadians have the role that we do around the world, to help people. Nicola was killed during a firefight in the Panjwai district on May 17, 2006. It was my father's birthday. She was the first female Canadian soldier to die in a combat role. And on the day of her death, she was also the first Canadian to call in fire since the Korean War. Following Nick's death, Canada came together to support my family, neighbors, friends, colleagues, complete strangers. We were surrounded by this incredible outpouring of love and support. In time, we came to understand that Nick's legacy of leadership, strength, and courage could continue to create a better world. The Captain Nicola Goddard Fund now celebrates and supports servicewomen and female veterans who, like Nicola, protect the values integral to Canada and who stand on guard for those less fortunate around the world. Nicola's top priority was always her people, her family, her soldiers, her community, her country. With the fund, we're able to help protect her people and also tell the stories of incredible Canadian servicewomen to inspire leaders in both military and civilian Canada.
I'm Shannon Busta, and thank you for joining us for the first episode of For Her Country, a podcast produced by the True Patriot Love Foundation and the Captain Nicola Goddard Fund. The voice you just heard belongs to Catherine Rusk, Nicola's sister. Catherine and the Goddard family have been instrumental in the creation of this podcast. Over the course of this series, we'll explore lessons in leadership from inspirational female leaders from across Canada's armed forces, all in honor of fallen Canadian military hero, Captain Nicola Goddard. I'm a journalist by trade, a civilian. I have never served in the military, nor has anyone in my immediate family. So I'd understand if you were wondering why I'm hosting this podcast. The short answer is that I was asked to by Teresa Sapara, a friend and veteran who I respect deeply. The long answer is that I was inspired by Nicola's story, and I wanted to do anything that I could to help spread awareness for her legacy and the Captain Nicola Goddard Fund. Over the course of producing this podcast, I have met brilliant and strong women, and our conversations have left me feeling inspired and given me a deeper understanding of the work of the Canadian military. So join me as we learn about Canada's military through the lens of the trailblazing women who have helped shape our armed forces. From base training to deployments, our guests will share their experiences with us, and along the way, we'll uncover universal lessons we can all benefit from. We want to take this opportunity to thank RBC for generously supporting this podcast series as presenting sponsor. RBC has been an advocate for True Patriot Love since 2010 and has committed over $1 million to support Canada's military members, veterans, and their families. Thank you, RBC. For our first interview of the series, I'm speaking with Major Jamie Phillips, the first female artillery troop commander deployed to Kandahar. Jamie was the recipient of the Order of Military Merit in 2015. She attended school with Nicola, and their relationship helped Jamie develop her own leadership style. Thanks so much for being here with us today, Jamie. Really looking forward to digging into your career and your experiences in the military. I'm hoping you can start us off by telling us what drew you to a career in the armed forces in the first place.
So my father served. He was an officer in the Armored Corps. So I grew up as part of that lifestyle, but my dad was very, very subtle. It was never like, you should join the army. It was, you know, there was no sort of significant, like, you should follow in my footsteps kind of business. But when I was 14, one of my friends, invited me to join the army cadet movement with him in our local area. So I went with him, and I think my dad wasn't necessarily opposed to it, but he, you know, certainly got tired of driving me around to things all the time. But then from there, I found out about the Royal Military College and, you know, free school. So thought that would be a good option for somebody who was really enjoying the Army cadet experience and sort of the camaraderie and the team aspect of it. And, there's really athletic parts. You know, I was part of the biathlon team, and then there's leadership parts where I got to be instructor on courses and things like that. It was really great. So it seemed like a natural next step for RMC. I honestly didn't consider very many other career options. It was just sort of very clear to me from a very young age that that's what I wanted to do.
So you mentioned RMC there, and for our listeners, that's the Royal Military College. It's based in Kingston, Ontario. So you attended there for your undergraduate degree. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, I loved RMC. It was like, looking back on it, I don't even understand how it's possible to do so many things in the run of a day. Like, it was, you know, I would get up in the morning, I think around 5:30, because 6 o'clock was when band practice started. So then you'd go and do band practice every day until, I think it was probably 7. And then it was go, you know, rush back, put your uniform on. Classes, I think, started at 8. And then you're in class all day until 4:30, and then at 4:30, whenever that ended, you were off to your varsity sports practice, and so that ended usually around 6:30, and then you'd scoot into the meal hall for supper sort of just before 7, because 7 was cutoff time, and then there was no more food after that, and then back upstairs, you know, to your dorm room and homework or whatever you had to try to smash out before sort of falling unconscious, you know, somewhere in the evening. Like, it was just such a busy time, and I have no idea how I did it, but mostly everybody that I knew sort of had these same crazy hours and schedules and lifestyles, and everybody sort of came out of it with a degree and a good experience. So yeah, I loved RMC.
It sounds pretty competitive. When I think back to my undergrad experience, I had 15 hours of class a week. So it sounds like you were doing more in a day than I was doing in a week. So kudos.
And I was an arts person. So I mean, shout out to the engineers.
You mentioned that RMC is built on four pillars. Could you explain what those are for us?
Yes. So there's the military pillar. So there, you know, there's drill, dress, ceremonial inspections, you know, the sort of the stuff that we focus on during that first month when we got there. There's the academic pillar, which is pretty straightforward. There's the physical fitness pillar. So there's physical fitness testing and the requirement to participate in the sport. And then bilingualism is the fourth pillar.
That's amazing. And it sounds like it would provide you with such an incredible foundation for anything in life.
I think so. I think I learned a lot there. And then the people that I met there are lifelong friends and important, really, like the experiences that we've shared together. I recently was back for my 15-year reunion in the fall, and it was so great to see some of those folks again and, you know, realize that really not that much has changed. It's nice.
On the topic of people that you met there, I believe that you actually attended RMC at the same time as Nicola Goddard. Could you tell us a little bit about your relationship with Nicola?
So Nicola was in third year when I was in first year at the Royal Military College. And what that means is, so again, in keeping with that sort of like always practicing leadership thing, a group of third years are put in charge of the first year class. So you get three third years and a fourth year, or it's changed, you know, now it's fourth years, I think. But at the time it was three third years and a fourth year that were our leadership staff, our 30-person group in my first year flight. And so Nicola was one of my third years who was in charge of us. So she was, you know, she was the first woman that I had met who was in the artillery. And at the time I was in the infantry. So it wasn't that I think necessarily drew me to her. But she was a great leader. Like, she had a really solid, strong foundation in caring for people and just being both competent, but also like wonderful and generous at the same time. You know, some people feel that like leadership has to come at a cost of care, or, you know, or of empathy or things like that. And she would have been so young, but she already had like such a well-developed blend of this like strong leadership. She was amazing. So we bonded because we were both on the biathlon team. I joined the biathlon team that year. She was one of my first year instructors. I remember my first interaction with her was, so when you're there for your first month, it's sort of like frosh week, except it's not fun. It's like the opposite of fun. And so your first month is like extra arduous compared to even like what the rest of your RMC time is going to look like. It's a bit of a, it's meant to form your team bond. Like, it's meant to sort of like forge you and fire together. So you come out the other end as this like cohesive, strong team. And so it's terrible. And you're doing a lot of physical activity. And I was having leg cramps like in the night. And I couldn't figure out why. And I was very worried that I was like having some sort of, you know, physical breakdown that was going to stop me from finishing my time at RMC. Like, it was all very dramatic because, of course, you're exhausted, so everything is just like huge. And I remember sidling up to her and sort of confiding in her that this has happened and I don't know what's happening and oh my god, I don't know what to do. And she was like, just sprinkle some salt on your food in the cafeteria, everything will be fine. Like, you're dehydrated, it's fine. Like, oh, thank God. Oh, I thought I was dying. You know, like it was very extreme. And she was like, it's okay, just put some salt on your food. And so I did. That's all it was. We were just doing a lot of physical activity and I wasn't used to it. So that was all. So in the summertime, we both went to Gagetown. So she was ahead of me in the training, but we all went down. All the army people went down together to Gagetown in the summer to do our training. So she was there too. And I will always remember, I think I was having boy troubles. And I was upset, like I had been visibly crying. And I remember that she saw me and she saw that I was upset and she came to my room and she said, so your choice, we can either talk about what's bothering you or I can show you my pictures from my summer face training last summer, because I was coming up on my summer face training. So obviously I didn't know what to expect. And so I said, no, face training, please. And so she came down and she brought her photo album and she sort of flipped through it with me and like showed me some of the things that I would expect to be doing on my summer training that summer. And so it took my mind off of my boy anguish. Just like did a really, really great job of being a supremely amazing leader. So she was great. And then we ended up being in the same trade. I changed to artillery in third year because of a medical return to training off of my infantry training, but it wasn't going well for me. Really, it wasn't the infantry wasn't a good fit for me. So that summer I transferred out to the artillery, and that's then sort of got to like follow in Nicola's footsteps through the training after that. And she became sort of, you know, she was the well-known woman, so that people would meet you and they'd be like, oh, do you know Nicola? Like, she became sort of like the emblem of my generation of artillery. She was like the front lady of our generation, kind of thing. So after that, you know, she sort of like forged the path for the rest of us.
And do you think that your personal leadership style was influenced by your exposure to Nicola?
I hope so. I got to be in charge of first years when I was in my fourth year. So like sort of the cycle kind of continued, and I really enjoyed it. And I, you know, I'm still friends with some of those people because I think, you know, in their moments of anguish, I tried to, you know, be that empathetic person for them. And, you know, you know, you're still in charge and you're still the leader and you're still, you know, very much in, you know, in the hierarchy, there's still a hierarchy, but you still, there are ways that you can relate to people and share in their challenges, especially, you know, it's their first year and they're away from home for the first time, things like that. So I think I definitely learned from her that it was okay to also be a human at the same time as you're being a leader. Like, that's fine. You can be both.
You know, the more I learn about Nicola, the more it becomes so obvious that she just had such strong leadership instincts at such an early age and was such an asset to the Canadian Forces. So thank you for helping us understand your relationship with her and allowing us to get to know her a bit better.
I'm Catherine Rusk. Captain Nicola Goddard was my sister, and I'd like to make a request. Military service can bring great challenges and sacrifices. Women in particular can face unique issues. Help True Patriot Love and the Captain Nicola Goddard Fund support Canada's servicewomen, veteran women, and their families. True Patriot Love Foundation is a national organization that supports the military and veteran community by funding critical programs across the country. Please consider donating today towards their mission at tplgoddardfund.com. No donation is too small. On behalf of my family and the Captain Nicola Goddard Fund, we thank you for your support.
This episode is sponsored by Trouble Victor Group, whose mission is to enable ex-military leaders to achieve their full potential in the marketplace. So you spend 4 years developing your leadership skills, your military training at RMC. You're exposed to strong leaders like Nicola. Can you tell us a little bit about your career trajectory once you graduated?
So after I graduated, I went to complete my final phase of artillery training in Gagetown, New Brunswick. And then after completing that, I got to be a support troop commander. So that's sort of the goal of the young graduate from the military college, is to be a troop commander or a platoon commander, depending on your trade. You are in charge of 30-ish folks, all ranks. You know, and you know, theoretically you're the boss, but in the Canadian Army we have a really great system, a really strong cadre of senior non-commissioned officers or senior NCOs, and those are folks who joined as privates and then sort of worked their way up through the ranks, as opposed to officers who join as officer cadets and then typically go to school right away. And then after their schooling, they arrive sort of these young, fresh, very junior leaders ready to take command of things. They get paired up with one of these senior non-commissioned officers who has, you know, 20 plus years of experience sometimes. And that becomes your sort of command team. And it's quite brilliant the way that it works out. So, you know, you show up all keen. I've completed my phase training. I know everything there is to know about the artillery, you know, in my own mind. You know, I was 21 years old and, you know, thought I was absolutely brilliant and ready to take this all on. And then they pair you up with this more experienced member of your trade who actually does have the experience and the ability to do the things that you're being asked to do. And then the two of you form this hopefully close relationship that is, you know, you are absolutely the leader. You're the figurehead. You get to, you know, you carry it on your shoulders for the decisions, good or bad. But then you've got this incredibly confident and capable advisor who sort of stands at your shoulder and sort of gently nudges you in the direction that you're trying to go in, and, you know, gives you advice and helps you out in difficult situations and gives you the benefit of their years of experience. So the way that we work it is pretty brilliant, I think. It's not something that all countries do. Not every country has that same senior non-commissioned officer cadre. So I think it's quite special. And I was really lucky. My first troop warrant officer was very experienced. You know, some would definitely call him crusty. I know I definitely did at the time. But he was great. You know, he guided me, he helped me. He was, you know, it's such a balance to do it in a way that's productive, because some, you know, you also don't want it to seem as though you aren't in control or that you don't have the ability to lead. I mean, we're very big on leadership. It's super important. So, you know, you have to be really careful that it's not an overbearing kind of relationship, but just one of mutual respect and, you know, advice and counsel and things like that. So I was really, really lucky. I got to command a troop right away. It was a support troop instead of a gun troop. So rather than having howitzers or like artillery cannons to as part of my troop, I had the things that you need in order to support the artillery firing. So I had some drivers, I had maintainers, I had the folks who were in charge of the radios, you know, like, so it's a broad mix of folks from different trades, different ranks, different situations. So it was a really interesting challenge for a young troop commander to come into that and get to manage it.
I'm kind of blown away. I'm thinking about, you know, what I was like at 21, and I certainly wasn't in any way prepared to lead a troop of 30 people. Were there many other young women in your kind of orbit at that time?
Going through my phase training, there were sort of one or two other women, I would say, on each of my sections and my courses, things like that. I was never the only one, but there was never like a critical mass either.
And so what was next for you? What came after that?
After that, I spent a year doing what's considered sort of an executive assistant or staff officer job, which is, you get to be the staff officer to a senior leader. So in that case, it was the commander of the combat training center in Gagetown, who was a colonel. And then I was posted to Petawawa, where I got to be a troop commander again. And that's when I did my deployment to Afghanistan.
I'm glad that you brought up your deployment. I believe that you went to Afghanistan in February of 2007. Could you tell us a bit about what that experience was like for you and give our audience a sense of what it's like to be deployed?
So every deployment is different, and every experience in Afghanistan is different too. But what mine was, as a troop, we would move around to new locations fairly often. Sometimes we'd be in one place for a couple months, sometimes we'd be in a place just for a couple days. So you jump around wherever the operations are happening so that you can best support. So we were rarely on Kandahar airfield. So, that's the stuff where, you'd see like the Tim Hortons and things like that, and you'd have like a more of a coalition feel. We were very much off by ourselves, which was, pluses and minuses for sure. So when we were out, we were sometimes staying in what's called a forward operating base, which is like a little bit built up. It's got a little bit of protection. We had some that had bunkers on them or modular tentage or things like that. And then other times we just full on like pulled up into a field and, stopped our vehicles and we're like, okay, this is where we live now. And sort of did that.
And what does camp in this situation look like? I'm picturing tents.
Dependent on the security situation. So, we slept out just in an open kind of situation like that when we weren't in an area where there was a potential for a ground attack. In other cases, we would go, if we were out in a place that was more dangerous, but we still had to just sort of do this like plop down and live here thing. You dig shell scrapes or, if you're there for long enough, you can dig a lot of protective space for yourself and for the guns. So a couple of places we were there for an extended or a long enough period of time that we could sort of dig in, ground is here, you sort of dig down, and then you'll sort of fill sandbags around the top to give you a little bit of extra protection.
I'm picturing like a trench from World War II.
Yeah, basically, but not as well constructed as those.
So you're often finding yourself sleeping under the stars, occasionally in things that resemble trenches. I can't help but wonder if you're showering and what you're eating on a day-to-day basis.
There wasn't showers when we were out, like when we were staying in a field like that. I would bucket wash my hair. It was much shorter then. I cut it all off before I went. I had sort of like a little nub ponytail so that I could wash it with a couple water bottles. We would sometimes build temporary showers. There was one that was built. We were co-located with some American Special Forces, so they had some interesting like gear that we didn't have, so they were able to build more things. Now, a huge part of it is baby wipe centric, like if you like wash the important bits. But at the time it was more kind of old timey. Like it was more like washcloth, basin soap. We did our laundry on washboards, not even joking. it was pretty interesting.
Can you give me a sense of the gender dynamics at this time? Was it typical for a female to be leading a gun troop on deployment?
So technically I was the first woman to lead a gun troop in Kandahar. Which means nothing, but it's just sort of an interesting title.
Was that for Canada or for all of the coalition forces?
I mean, Canada was the only one who had women integrated into the artillery at that time. So the Americans and the Brits didn't. Until like much later, which was sometimes problematic when working in a multinational environment. No, it was me. Between our three troops, so that's, 120 people or whatever it was in the battery. It was a really beefy battery. Like we really chunked things up for the deployment. So probably with 120 of us, there were two women. I was the troop commander, and the other woman was one of my sergeants. So they paired the two ladies together for safety. I don't know, moral support.
What was that like, being one of two females? What were the challenges you faced?
Like my troops were good. Like my troops were fine. It's relatively normal. Even then it was like less normal, but it was still relatively normal for Canadian troops because we integrated women into the combat trades in 1989 and I was deploying in 2007. So Canada was like super ahead of the game. So even when I joined, like one generation of women had already kind of like come in and suffered through it all. So it was like, there were challenges for me, but it wasn't like I was the brand new first woman ever. But on deployment, working with some of the other nations where women were not gender integrated into the combat trades yet, I was the first woman that they had ever worked with. And it was kind of confusing and upsetting for them in a lot of ways. And like the Americans especially were having, they were debating it at that time. Like they were having, in the media, they were having debates and they were having these like just horrifying discussions over like all of the terrible things that would happen if you incorporated women into the combat trades. So that becomes kind of awkward when you're there, like, hello, yes, we're integrated, it's fine. As it turns out, the army didn't come crumbling down.
Were there any instances of somebody from another force being rude or inappropriate or crossing the lines in terms of aggressive behavior? And if so, how did you deal with it?
Yeah, always. It almost became like a matter of course. Not as much, although sometimes there's outward, like, really obvious rudeness, but more often, I feel like it's like a slightly subtle, somewhere between outward aggression and microaggression, sort of dancing that line where you could like maybe convince someone that they had misinterpreted it if they took it poorly. There was an individual, an American officer who was working on one of the forward operating bases where we spent some time. And he felt the need to just constantly like vocally espouse all the reasons why it was a terrible idea to have women in the combat trades, like to me, around my soldiers, just in front of my face, not super helpful. But my troops they did the absolute best thing, which was just act like confused about what this guy was going on about. You know what I mean? Like they just, by perceiving it as normal and having the other people see them perceiving it as normal, I think that was the best thing that anybody could have done. I have learned that I can't convince people that women should be in the army if they don't think they should be. Like that is one of those like deeply held beliefs that people have, that I cannot change their minds through debate. I can maybe sometimes change their minds through performance or through action or experience or things of that nature. Like if they work with me for a while, maybe they'll be okay with it after, but it's not something that you can like tell people and they get it. So I was still trying back then, but it was such a pointless endeavor.
Do you mind me asking what some of those things that guy would say? Like, what were his reasons for why women shouldn't be there?
They're all the same reasons that continue, like, to this day, if you ever read any of the comment sections of any article about women in anything ever. So the main arguments were always physical strength. So his argument was that I would never be able to pull him out of a combat situation if he were to be killed or shot. And my answer to that was always, okay, well, he weighed almost 300 pounds. It would have been very difficult for really anybody in my organization to pull him out of a situation like that. I often get the men have an innate desire to protect women. Therefore, in a combat situation, if you have a woman, rather than be doing their jobs, men will be going out of their way to like fling themselves in front of you and protect you from danger, which is a thing that has never happened to me. And I like to tell people that none of my troops threw themselves in front of me at all when we were under fire of any kind. So that was great. And the other one that people say is that having a woman there will undermine the cohesion, the unit cohesion. So there's that factor where it's sort of like, that camaraderie can't possibly be built with a woman there. The proof is in the pudding. Like I have lots of friends in the army. It's all been fine. No units have come crumbling apart and disintegrated because they put women in them, you know.
How did you maintain a positive outlook while being subjected to bad behavior like this?
I mean, I really didn't. Like, I got really irritated about it. I think I'm a little bit better now. I've had more experience. I've deployed I've been in a multinational experience since then that was quite challenging for the same reason. So it's like I've had more practice now. I've grown and matured and like worked on my control. But at the time, it was mostly just like it would make me furious. I would either say nothing or say, you know, something really smart alecky that was probably not helpful, but it, you know, just felt like the best defense at the time was just to be, you know, on the offense. You know, I would gripe to anybody that I could who was willing to absorb my fury for moral support. But I was really lucky. I had a really strong troop warrant officer for that deployment as well, like sort of a different guy, but the same version of the, like, you know, he has more time in the army than I have alive at that time, you know, so he's a great moral support. And, you know, in sort of like a fatherly slash like leadership kind of just like, shh, it's fine, you're doing fine, shh, it's fine, don't listen to them, don't worry about it, it's okay. And so just knowing that I had the, you know, the love and support of my crew was more important than what this like idiot thinks.
And the challenges you faced, I mean, obviously they've not been so overwhelming that they've that you've felt the need to leave, because you're still in the military today. Can you tell us a little bit about what keeps you serving?
It's the people. I love the people. You know, for every asshole, there's like 100 amazing people that are just like, they become great lifelong friends. And it sort of, it forges these like weird bonds that I didn't really realize until I had a job 2 years ago. I worked at the Privy Council office in like a public service environment. So I worked with civilians for the first time, you know, and we're pretty insular in the army. Like, we don't do a lot of like cross-pollination with other organizations or other parts of the government. So it was my first time working with like real people. And so at one point, I have a cottage in New Brunswick that I co-owned, and there was a massive pile of snow that winter. There was like 9 feet of snow in the cottage, and somebody called me from New Brunswick and was like, hey, I'm worried about the roof. You know, you might want to come down here and just like have a look, because I don't know, it seems like it could be problematic. I was like, okay, well, I'll just, you know, I'll get together a crew and I'll go down and shovel it off next weekend. It's like a 12-hour drive. It's fine. And so I sort of put it out on Facebook, like, hey, anybody want to come help me shovel? You know, I'll be there Saturday morning, 9 a.m. You know, bring your shovel. There's no hot water, but, you know, there's beer. Come on down. And people did, you know what I mean? Like, you have access to this like amazing network of folks that you can call on for any like insane life issue or favor or problem that you have. You can just call them and be like, hey, I need you to take care of my dog for like 2 months. They're like, yeah, okay, sounds great. How much does he eat? You know, like, it's a very, because you're not around your family, because you're moving around all the time, you get like a new family.
And before I let you go, if you had one piece of advice for young women out there looking to advance their careers and build their leadership skills, what would it be?
I think be yourself is something that is, you know, it sounds trite and it sounds, you know, it's like what everybody says. But I think when you join the army, you sort of sometimes, I think maybe less so with new generations, but you feel like you have to conform to a version of like what a leader looks like, you know what I mean? And you have to, and that leader is usually a dude, you know, he's usually yelling, it's sort of, you know, kind of beefy. Like, it's not achievable. And if that's not who you are, like, I can't go in and pretend that I'm, you know, a 6 foot tall blonde dude, you know what I mean? Like, I can't just be another person. So it's not convincing if I go in and try to lead like that's what I'm doing. So I think, and people say this, and I think it's true, is that like troops can tell, like your troops can tell if you're faking it. So there's no point, you know, so even if you're a success, you're going to be a success because you're a fraud, you know, like it's not worth it. Just, you can be yourself. You know, the military is changing. The leadership styles are changing. We're putting a lot more emphasis now on like that emotional intelligence factor that is like really inspiring, and I really like to see it. So you can be yourself, it's okay, you know, like you have something that you are bringing to the table, or you wouldn't have gotten as far as you've gotten. So just sort of figure out what that thing is and it'll be fine. You just don't try to be something else, or don't try to Don't try to act in a certain way because you think that's what a leader acts like. It's not going to work.
Jamie, thank you so much for joining us today and being so generous with your time and with your stories and experience. I think we've all learned a lot from you.
Yeah, of course.
And on the next episode of For Her Country, I'll be speaking with retired Lieutenant Colonel Eleanor Taylor. Eleanor is a native of Antigonish, Nova Scotia, who recently completed a remarkable 25-year career as a regular force infantry officer. She has completed multiple deployments overseas, including Kosovo and later Kandahar, where she led operations with soldiers from the Canadian, U.S., and Afghan armies. She now runs a business focused on supporting the development of teams and leaders who thrive in adversity. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed my conversation with Eleanor. So here's a quick clip from our conversation where we dive into her experience with failure and how it made her a better leader. I hope you tune in.
The most difficult phase, the most difficult infantry phase, is the one where we learn to be an infantry platoon commander. And I failed that phase on the second last day. And it was kind of a devastating, public, humiliating blow for me. And I really thought maybe this is it, you know, maybe this is the end for me in this profession.
And before we sign off, I'd like to share an excerpt from one of the letters Nicola Goddard sent home to her family while she was on deployment in Afghanistan. We'll be using these letters throughout the podcast to help give you a sense of what life is like on deployment. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening.
Hello, everyone. Well, as you all know, I arrived safe and sound into Afghanistan on February 1st, 2006. It took us 4 days to fly here. Quite an adventurous 4 days. As you know, I was pretty apprehensive about the trip into Kandahar airfield. I knew that we were going to fly tactically and was a little concerned that I'd totally embarrass myself and throw up all over some of my soldiers. I'd never been in a Herc, the big planes that the military uses to lift heavy equipment and move personnel. Herc stands for Hercules. It was huge. They crammed in so much kit, it was amazing. They drove the tractors right onto the plane to drop off the crates with our kit in them. Then we got on. I discovered that the reason they can fit so much stuff is because they cram the people all together in the smallest space possible. We sat in four rows, the center two with our backs to each other, facing the other row. We had to sit with our legs alternating because otherwise we didn't fit. The flight was 3.5 hours long. I didn't sleep much. The tactical flying part was pretty tame. No one from my flight threw up, which was nice. Morale is pretty high, as we are all glad to finally be here. The last check was 196 days, give or take, until we come home. I think of you all often, and can't wait to see you all again. I hope that life on the home front is interesting as usual, and that you are all remembering to smile. Nick.
For Her Country is hosted by me, Shannon Busta. It is written and produced by me and Katrina Bolak. Our music is by Whiskey Wolf and Oceanic Piano. A special thank you to Catherine Rusk and the Goddard family and the team at True Patriot Love for their support throughout this project. And thank you to our series sponsor, RBC, and our episode sponsor, Treble Victor Group. The letter shared in this episode is from the biography Canada's Daughter, written by Sally Goddard. You can find it on Amazon. It was read by Anna Maximew. This project was produced with the True Patriot Love Foundation and the Captain Nicola Goddard Fund. True Patriot Love is Canada's leading organization that supports military members and their families. It administers the Captain Nicola Goddard Fund, which was started by the Goddard family to support women in the military in honor of Nicola. To learn more about this podcast and the great work of this organization, please visit tplgoddardfund.com and consider donating if you can. If you like this podcast, please rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts. See you next time.